Ora, ora.
Hello, I'm Hanea Ahu, bringing you the Week in Parliament with Tom Fruin and Rhys Lyon. The House resumes next week, ending a three-week adjournment that began just before Easter. MPs will be back in their debating chamber at 2 p.m. on Tuesday when, as Tom Fruin reports, the Speaker David Carter will announce the winner of the Northland by-election.
It's hardly new news. The winner on the night was New Zealand First Leader Winston Peters. His majority actually increased in the official count, and that was in the writs returned on April the 14th, advising the Speaker officially of the result. And that's what he'll be announcing at his first opportunity, which is when Parliament resumes at 2 p.m. on Tuesday. But the interesting question is whether Mr. Peters will keep his list seat. There's nothing in the law preventing an MP from holding a list seat and an electorate seat. But an MP can only cast one vote. So if Mr. Peters keeps his list seat, which is highly unlikely because he'll lose out on the extra financial and other benefits from having his party increasing its number in the House from 11 to 12, the overall total of MPs will drop to 120. If he does resign his list seat, the Speaker informs the Electoral Commission of the vacancy, and the Electoral Commission then goes down the party list, which in New Zealand First case has 14 names on it, to find a replacement, and that would bring the number in House back up to 121. As of Tuesday morning, though, the Speaker's office had not received advice from Mr. Peters that he was resigning from his list seat, but as they say, watch this space.
Thanks, Tom. Now over to Rhys for his report on the week just passed.
There were no Select Committee meetings for a second week in a row, though that's not because of a lack of workload in Parliament's engine rooms. There are currently 18 bills before Select Committees, as well as 35 pending financial reviews of government agencies, and another 60 inquiries and briefings for committees to get through. Looking to the final week of the three-week Easter adjournment, there is so far one Select Committee meeting scheduled. That's the Māori Affairs Committee, whose members will be back at Parliament on Monday to make progress on four items of business. They'll be looking at two treaty settlement bills, the Te Hiku Claim Settlement and the Te Karo Aumaki Claim Settlement. And also on that committee's agenda on Monday will be consideration of the Waitangi National Trust Board Amendment and the Māori Language Te Reo Māori Bill. That last bill is focused on the continuing revitalisation of Te Reo Māori and seeks to repeal the Māori Language Act 1987 and Part 4A of the Broadcasting Act 1989 in order to establish an independent entity, Te Matawai, to provide leadership in regard to the health of the Māori language. Making a submission on that bill in Auckland last month was broadcaster and former MP Willie Jackson, now chairman of the National Urban Māori Authority.
We see the bill as a betrayal of urban Māori from the previous Minister of Māori Affairs. And he has come up with a bill that is totally against the interests of Māori in Auckland.
The former minister Willie Jackson was referring to there was former Māori Party co-leader and Māori Affairs Minister Peter Sharples.
How he came up with it and why he came up with it is beyond me and beyond us, given the Māori language renaissance started at marae like his. The revival, the Māori renaissance, wasn't started in the heart of Ngāpuhi or Tainui or Ngāti Porou, but it was started at urban marae like Hoani Waititi. And for some reason, the former minister forgot all that and got all romantic and decided that the tribes deserved this right to lead this kaupapa. Despite the type of kōrero that came from, has come from some of our rangatira in the reo, like Timothy Karetu, who said, why should the language be returned to the control of the same iwi who let it die?
Mr. Jackson questioned the bill's underlying intention that the future implementation of Te Reo revitalisation should be led by iwi.
Tribes don't have any right to this kaupapa. The reality is that this kaupapa was driven by our practitioners in the city, by the karetus also, the academics who worked with our people at the coalface, advanced this kaupapa when tribes left the language to die. So it's saddening to see what's happened, and it's particularly sad that we've been cut out and totally left out of the equation.
chairman of the National Urban Māori Authority, Willie Jackson. And later, there was a submission from a representative from the rural Northland iwi, Ngāti Hine, Waharoa Shortland. Mr. Shortland welcomed the inclusion of iwi as leaders of a Māori language strategy, but questioned the establishment of a governing board in order to implement it.
I hate the thought that all we're pushing for in these new structures is just another way for another group of people to gather up funding streams towards themselves or towards a kaupapa over here, and then we'll mix it all up, and before you know it, you don't know where it went. I'd say let the people who say iwi can't do it, watch us.
Ngāti Hine representative Waharoa Shortland with that submission on the Māori Language Bill to the Māori Affairs Committee in Auckland last month. That bill is due to be reported back from the committee by July the 31st.
And with no select committees to report, Rhys had time to stop by at the Hansard office and talk to the editor, Lawrence Pratchett.
Could you tell us what the reporters do when they're in the chamber, the two reporters that you see on the television? What are they doing?
The reporters are there to listen to the proceedings, to take note of any interjections, to keep track of any of the business that's going through the House, and to monitor that amount of time in the chamber for what's called their turn. So their turn can last from 5 minutes to 7.5 minutes, and sometimes for 10 minutes. And so they are there in the chamber monitoring all that activity for their, let's say, a 5 minute turn, and then at the end of the 5 minutes, their colleague on the Hansard table will tap the table twice, and that means that their turn has finished and they're about to take over. The new reporter is about to take over. At that moment, the reporter leaves the chamber and comes back down to the Hansard office, which is directly underneath the chamber. And they open up a document in our production system and start transcribing that turn.
So when they're in the chamber, they're using shorthand?
Some reporters are, but most these days don't have shorthand. Some certainly use shorthand in order to take down those interjections, and those skills are very helpful. But it's all the proceedings are recorded on a sound recording called FTR, and so that is picked up through the microphones in the House and at each member's seat, and that's all recorded, and we can then access that when we come back downstairs to transcribe our turns. Typically, a reporter will come back down with, a page recording the information on their turn, and some interjections that were made and some other information that they might have found useful, but mostly what they're doing is transcribing what they can hear on the audio file into a written document in our production system. And say if it's a question time turn, that will involve the question and answer string, so the member asking the question, we type out the question, and then the minister answering, and so on through the supplementary questions. They have a certain amount of time to complete that before they have to go back up to the House, and those times can range from 45 minutes through to about an hour and 40, depending on the length of the turn. Mm-hmm. And their next turn time is allocated according to a schedule roster that's set up early on in the day. And so they rotate through that roster, having about several turns during the parliamentary day.
And how many reporters are there?
Typically, there are 10 on the roster for each day, and so the turns are divided up equally amongst those reporters. There are also some other staff here working on editing, which is a process that takes place after the turns have been transcribed.
There are some rules about what interjections are published and what aren't. Could you explain that to us?
That's right. there are a whole lot of rules set out in our precedent manual and some other documents as well, mm-hmm. Which help us translate the standing orders and speaker's rulings and all of that kind of material into into a guide that can be easily understood by our reporters and editors. So we'll look at that when some sort of procedural matter comes up like that we're unsure of how to handle, or that's slightly out of the ordinary. We can go to the precedent manual and find the guidance there on how to handle that particular situation. So yeah, we're often looking up those documents in order to know how to process an interjection that wasn't responded to, or that was responded to, or a point of order that was, say, ruled out of order, or one that was became the subject of significant debate thereafter.
So generally, if there's an interjection and it's not responded to by the person on their feet, that won't get recorded. The interjection won't. Is that right?
That's right. Even though we will be able to hear it on the tape,
yeah.
Depending on the circumstances, it's unlikely that an interjection that is not responded to by the main speaker, so the person who has the floor at the time, what we call has the call, then that interjection won't go into the written record of what happened.
And after talking to Hansard editor Lawrence Pratchett, Rhys had a chat with the manager of Hansard, Lindley Earls.
Hansard has been produced as a bound volume from the very, very beginning. In 1987, it was available electronically on the Knowledge Basket website. From 2003, we've been publishing Hansard onto the parliamentary website. Before the start of this new service, we sent members their first draft in hard copy, and they had 12 hours to return it to us. And then we published onto the web. We would go through our processes, and the first publicly available copy of that sitting day's record was within about 3 working days afterwards, which is quite a long time, and certainly quite a long time compared to the service that we're offering now.
It's now available online within 2.5 hours.
That's right. During the interregnum last year, we worked hard on developing a new way of publishing Hansard. So at the start of the 50th Parliament, we offered a new service for members and for the public, whereby we are sending members their speeches electronically by email, and at the same time we're publishing directly to a draft transcript on the website.
And sending it to the members, that has a purpose for them to check the accuracy of it?
Definitely. Members have a right to check that we've got it, we've reported them correctly, and if we've made mistakes, obviously we will correct them.
You must have had some good feedback about the speed of the service.
We've had feedback from members and from the public about the efficient production of Hansard and having it so available so quickly.
Do you have reporters taking it down in shorthand, or is it all typed directly up?
That's a very interesting question, because Hansard has changed significantly since 1992. That was when we ended the process of taking the debates down in shorthand and then dictating it back to typists. So that was the case for many, many years, up to 1992. Since then, our staff type their own turns and edit it at the same time.
Could you tell me a little bit about the role of Hansard as the official recording of Parliament?
We wanted to provide a more immediate public record of the debates. We wanted our record to still be relevant in the face of the easy availability of the debates in various other forms. On the website, for instance, you can access the audio visual of it. You can access PTV, watching it as it happens. There's also the audio and web streaming sources. So, yes, our view was that we had to be relevant in the face of all that.
Hansard manager Lindley Earls talking to Rhys Lyon. And you can also see and hear Parliament by going to our website at parliamenttoday.co.nz. There you'll find podcasts, including one of this programme, our Twitter feed, and a link to our YouTube channel with video highlights from the Chamber. Also on the webpage, you'll find reports on debates in the Chamber. This is the best way of keeping up with what's going on in the House, especially during the evening sittings. Now for a preview of the government's agenda for the first week back. Here's the Leader of the House, Gerry Brownlee.
When the House resumes on the 28th of April, it's the government's intention to begin the debate on the appropriations 2013-14 confirmation and validation bill, as well as a number of other second and third readings on the order paper.
After making that business statement on the Thursday before Easter, Mr Brownlee took this question from his opposition shadow, Labor's Chief Whip, Chris Hipkins.
Mr Speaker, I notice on the order paper that there are currently only 21 government orders of the day available on the order paper, and in fact there are 22 members' orders of the day available on the order paper. I wonder whether the Leader of the House has given any consideration to increasing the allocation of time to members' orders of the day, given the government seem to be having difficulty filling their half of the order paper.
The Honourable Gerry Brownlee.
Well, Mr Speaker, the relative inexperience of the Shadow Leader of the House is showing through in that statement. He will know that this is a very busy government. They are big pieces of legislation that are before the House at the present time. And if I might quote a former Leader of the House when a similar question was posed to him about 2004, his reply then, sir, was, "Stand by, more is on its way."
Leader of the House, Gerry Brownlee, whose business statement identified one bill up for debate next week.
That's the Appropriation 2013-14 Confirmation and Validation Bill, the legislation putting into place the public finance transfers between Output Order 2014, which itself divvies out budget funding within a handful of government departments. Debate on that bill will this year be rolled into a joint Crown Entities and Annual Review debate, which is set down to last 9 hours after the Business Committee agreed to combine the debates on the performance and operations of departments and Crown Entities, state enterprises and other public organisations, and the government's financial statements. The annual review debate is normally 7 hours, but to accommodate the 9-hour debate, the Business Committee agreed last year that the additional 2 hours be taken from the debate on the Prime Minister's statement, which was reduced earlier this year from 15 hours to 13 hours. Tom will be back with more on the annual review process later in the program.
Thanks, Rhys. Now, before we hear from Tom about another aspect of Parliament's role as watchdog on government spending, here's the mystery voice.
The Week in Parliament, Mystery Voice.
Does he stand by his answer that, quote, over the last few years, the government has introduced stab-resistant body armour, spit hoods, batons and pepper spray progressively from 2010, unquote.
Who is the mystery voice and what is he talking about? Here it is again.
The Week in Parliament, Mystery Voice.
Does he stand by his answer that, quote, over the last few years, the government has introduced stab-resistant body armour, spit hoods, batons and pepper spray progressively from 2010, unquote.
I'll be back with the identity of the mystery voice later in the program. Now, Tom Frewen reports on an upcoming debate in which MPs get the chance to run a fine-tooth comb over government spending.
Rhys talked about the Appropriation Confirmation and Validation Bill before. There's another debate coming up on the annual reviews of Crown entities, public organisations and state enterprises. This is held with the House sitting as a committee, the minister in charge of the entity or enterprise, beside the committee chairman on the floor of the House, able to answer MPs' questions informally. The debate is based on the reports of select committees of their annual reviews of these organisations. For instance, the Commerce Committee has issued a report on its annual review of TVNZ, which is a state-owned enterprise. Given the current fuss over the future of Campbell Live on TVNZ's rival channel, TV3, I thought it would be interesting to hear the conversation at the committee about current affairs television, starting with a statement from the Chief Executive, Kevin Kenrick.
We are committed long-term to the production of news and current affairs because the skills and capabilities required are things that we do uniquely well. The production of other shows, there are any number of players who can do that as well and in some cases better. And if you were to look outside of news and current affairs, somewhere in the region of 90% of our local productions are outsourced. That doesn't demonstrate a lack of commitment to them. That demonstrates a commitment to the local production community. And we continue to screen those shows and they continue to perform really well and meet the diverse needs of our audiences.
Greens broadcasting spokesman Gareth Hughes asked Mr Kenrick if TVNZ regarded itself as a simply commercial broadcaster.
I come back to what are we obliged to do. The functions of TVNZ are to be a successful national television and digital media company, providing a range of content and services on a choice of delivery platforms and maintaining its commercial performance. That's what we're obliged to do. So we don't set those rules, we just act in accordance with them.
Another committee member, Labor's broadcasting spokeswoman Claire Curran, was keen to hear more from the chief executive about TVNZ's current affairs programs.
You say that the Sunday program is your most watched current affairs show with 600,000 odd viewers. Well, I'm sure
they're not odd. Some of them are quite normal people.
Is Q&A funded by taxpayers to around 900,000 per year with around 70,000 viewers your least watched program? And why does this taxpayer-funded program not have a bigger audience and is not being shown at a different time?
Jeff, do you want to comment on that?
It certainly isn't our least watched program, so I guess that's the first thing. Sunday morning, traditionally, if you look across most major markets in the world, is a really good location to put current affairs programming. And if you look, it's interesting, if you look in the Australian market, the UK market, and the US market, it's one of those places where you can actually get a very high-quality audience, and then the issues that are discussed and debated naturally then flow into the 6 o'clock news bulletins. And so that's the same thing that you've seen in the New Zealand market. So
not in Australia, if I can contradict you there, because Qanda is a very highly watched program,
yeah,
and is played in prime time on Australian television on the ABC, which is a public broadcaster. Why is it that Q&A could not, which has such an investment and is such quality programming, as you say, why is that not being shown in prime time?
Well, because the audience that the show attracts is not significant enough for us to actually place it in prime time.
How do you know that it wouldn't, though? Because you're not giving it a chance.
I guess we have a great deal of research into the performance of a variety of different shows from a variety of different sources, and I guess it's our professional opinion,
yes,
that show would not deliver a massive audience.
Well, I'm just challenging you on this because in Australia, it is a clearly different approach that's been taken by the ABC, and it has a high profile and it generates news.
As a business, we make money in prime time.
Mm.
So we make money between 6 o'clock and 10 o'clock. If we were a retail store, it would be a rational, logical thing to close your doors outside of that time, but we don't. And what we've got to do is make sure that the shows we play in prime time appeal to hundreds of thousands, and outside of that, we can accommodate shows that might appeal to tens of thousands. One of the great developments as the market embraces more on demand is we can take some of those more niche appeal contents, make them available at whatever time the audience choose to view them.
TVNZ Chief Executive Kevin Kenrick appearing there before the Commerce Committee for its annual review of the state-owned television broadcaster.
Thanks, Tom. Now once more, here's the mystery voice.
The Week in Parliament, Mystery Voice.
Does he stand by his answer that, quote, over the last few years, the government has introduced stab-resistant body armour, spit hoods, batons and pepper spray progressively from 2010, unquote.
And that's Mahesh Bindra, a New Zealand First List MP since last September. He's his party's spokesman on corrections, and he was putting a question to Corrections Minister Poseida Sam Lotu-Inga, who had trouble hearing it.
Does he stand by his answer that, quote, over the last few years, the government has introduced stab-resistant body armour, spit hoods, batons and pepper spray progressively from 2010, unquote?
The Honourable Poseida Sam Lotu-Inga.
For the benefit of the member again, yes.
Supplementary question.
Supplementary question. Mahesh, order. 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 Supplementary question, Mahesh Bindra.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Was it an April Fool's Day joke that batons have been introduced to New Zealand's corrections facilities since 2010? If not, which prisons have them, and where are they stored apart from the prison museum?
Did the minister not hear the question? I'm going to ask the member to repeat. It's very hard to hear the member. Could he repeat the question? And could I have a little less noise from my right-hand side? Mahesh Bindra.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Was it an April Fool's Day joke that bans have been introduced to New Zealand's corrections facilities since 2010? If not, which prisons have them, and where are they stored apart from the prison museums?
Sorry,
Honourable Pesitar, Sam Lodewinger.
Forbearance, Mr. Speaker. Could he please repeat that again?
All he wants to know is which prisons use batons. I think that's the essence of the question. I'll allow the member for the last time to read the question. If the minister hasn't heard it, then we're going to have to move forward.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I hope this is clear this time.
So do I.
Was it an April Fool's Day joke that batons have been introduced to New Zealand's corrections facilities since 2010? If not, which prisons have them, and where are they stored apart from the prison museum?
There are three questions. The Minister has the ability to answer any one of those. Honourable Pesitar,
well,
Sam Lodewinger.
This sounds like an April Fool's question, sir. The answer to the first part is no.
And that concludes questions for... I will answer.
Supplementary question.
Oh, sorry, I apologise. Is there a further supplementary question? Supplementary question, Mr. Spindra.
Does he stand by his statement yesterday that the privately run Mount Eden Corrections Facility is, quote, one of the highest performing prisons in New Zealand, unquote? If so, did he mean that out of all the prisons in New Zealand, it has the highest proportion of prisoner-on-staff assaults in both the serious and non-serious categories?
Honourable Pesitar Sam Lodewinger, either of those two questions.
Yeah, look, Mr. Speaker, the answer to the first part is yes. And as I said yesterday, for the member, I'll repeat it again, it is the top prison performer on the prison performance table, which measures core security, internal procedures and rehabilitation. Thank you.
And that now concludes questions for oral answer.
Corrections Minister Pesitar Sam Lotu-Inga, answering questions in the House from his New Zealand First shadow, Mahesh Bindra. This week's Mystery Voice. More on our webpage, Parliament Today, allonword.co.nz. I'm Hanea Ahu, and I'll be back with Tom Fruin and Rhys Lyon and another report from Parliament at the same time next week.